The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander and Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. And we're reading today from the June 19th, 2020 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a street scene. It's kind of smoky or maybe foggy. In the middle ground is a line of, looks like just dozens of police officers in riot gear. And in the foreground, one of those police officers is coming forward. He's got his shield out in front and he's got his arm raised with some sort of baton, looking like he's ready to strike somebody. His eyes look furious. The headline is "A Need for Reform. What's the best way to curtail police violence?" And that is our first main story. Police violence sparks demands for reform. What happened? Scenes of police across the nation assaulting peaceful protesters ignited widespread outrage this week, adding momentum to calls for police reform in the wake of the killing of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer. Hundreds of videos, many shot on cell phones, depicted police in cities across the country beating protesters with batons and throwing them to the pavement, firing tear gas and rubber bullets into nonviolent crowds and assaulting reporters. Some incidents prompted disciplinary action and even criminal charges. In Atlanta, six officers who pulled two college students from a car and tasered them were charged with assault. So was a New York City officer who hurled a woman to the street, causing a concussion. In the most widely shared video, police in Buffalo pushed Martin Gugino, 75, to the pavement and then walked past his prone body as blood poured from his ear. Even friends of mine who are different races are saying, "Oh, I see it now," said Leslie McSpadden, the mother of Michael Brown, who was killed by police in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014. In several cities, outrage over aggressive police tactics helped spur legislative action and promises of reform. The Minneapolis City Council pledged to dismantle the city's police department and rethink the city's approach to public safety. Amid calls to defund police departments, the mayors of New York City and Los Angeles promised to divert money from police budgets into social programs. On the federal level, House Democrats unveiled expansive legislation that would create a national use-of-force standard, ban chokeholds, and create a national registry to track police misconduct. Amid a sea change in public attitude, President Trump offered a staunch defense of police, calling 99% of officers great, great people. He suggested on Twitter that the man pushed by Buffalo police, a longtime Catholic peace activist, was an Antifa provocateur, echoing a false claim by a reporter who works for the Kremlin-owned outlet Sputnik. "It just makes no sense that we're fanning the flames right at this time," said GOP Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. What the editorial said: "Policing in America needs to change," said the Albany New York Times Union. "We can start by demilitarizing departments, stripping them of equipment and tactics more appropriate for war zones than America's streets, and train them in de-escalation. We also need to end qualified immunity," said the Boston Globe. "The legal doctrine, which grants police broad immunity from civil liability for their actions, has provided a shield for too many abusive officers. The House is considering legislation to remove qualified immunity, and doing so would send a timely message that the days of legalized winking at police abuses are over. Don't let bad events trigger a rush to bad policies, said the Wall Street Journal. Reforms are needed, including more public transparency about police misconduct and reducing the power of unions, which protect rogue officers. But a political drive to defund police risks a return to the high crime era of the 1960s and 70s that damaged so many American cities. Crime is already surging this year in many cities, aided by liberal law enforcement policies. What the columnist said. The police are rioting, said Jamel Bowie in the New York Times. The horrifying scenes of indiscriminate violence against protesters exercising their First Amendment rights represent an attack on civil society and have created more anger and disorder, not less. Faced with burning national anger over their own misconduct, police have responded with an assertion of power and impunity. They're effectively saying, so what? Changing the laws is not enough, said Christy Lopez in the Washington Post. We must reimagine the role police play in public safety. They're currently called on to respond to drug overdoses and the crises of the mentally ill, rouse the homeless, resolve family disputes, and deal with myriad other social problems. All defunding means is handing those responsibilities off to agencies better equipped to handle them. Pull police back, and it's people of color who will suffer most, said Quinn Hillier in WashingtonExaminer.com. Between 1993 and 2005, aggressive and expanded policing dropped the number of black victims of violent crime by nearly two-thirds. Meanwhile, from 2015 to 2019, the number of unarmed black civilians killed by cops dropped from 38 to 9. Yes, there are bad cops, but most really are the good guys. Reduce their number, and more black lives will be lost to crime. And black lives matter. Reforms that target bad apples are missing the point, said Alec Karatsanis in Slate.com. The deeper problem is the daily, largely invisible violence of cops stopping and arresting black men and women over expired licenses and traffic violations, locking them up for minor drug possession, and imposing overly harsh sentences that marks millions with a criminal record that closes off opportunities for employment, health care, and housing. Very little of this contributes to public safety. Yet in America, this systemic destruction is what good cops do. Title of the controversy of the week is The General's Revolt. Is the military turning on Trump? General Jim Mattis stayed silent as long as he could, said David Swerdlich in the Washington Post. But when President Trump last week threatened to send active duty U.S. troops into American cities to quell the nationwide protests, Trump's one-time defense secretary finally ripped his former boss in an eye-popping public statement. Mattis said he was angry and appalled to see Trump use the National Guard to forcefully clear peaceful protesters from streets in front of the White House so he could brandish a Bible in front of St. John's Episcopal Church. Never did I dream, Mattis said, that U.S. troops would be ordered under any circumstances to violate the constitutional rights of their fellow citizens, much less to provide a bizarre photo op for the elected commander-in-chief. Trump, Mattis said, is the first president in my lifetime who does not try to unite the American people, does not even pretend to try. I was also sickened by last week's event, said former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mike Mullen in TheAtlantic.com, and am deeply worried that the men and women of our armed forces are being co-opted for political purposes by a president with open disdain for the Constitution. It's not just Madison Mullen, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. The entire security establishment is revolting against Trump. Defense Secretary Mark Esper infuriated Trump by publicly opposing his wish to invoke the Insurrection Act and send troops from the Army's 82nd Airborne Division into the streets of Washington, D.C. Two other former chairmen of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, retired generals Martin Dempsey and Colin Powell, have also made blistering denunciation of Trump's authoritarian instincts. The current chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Mark Milley, issued a pointed memo to all the armed services reminding them that their ultimate loyalty is to the Constitution, which gives Americans the right to freedom of speech and peaceful assembly. The generals know an apolitical army is central to American democracy, said Jonathan Stevenson in the New York Times. If Trump persists in seeing the military as his personal police force, we may see its leaders engage in disciplined disobedience. Under our Constitution, the military answers to a civilian commander-in-chief, said Victor David Hansen in NationalReview.com. That's why these not-so-retiring retired generals should not be involving themselves in politics. Presidents from George Washington to George H.W. Bush have deployed U.S. troops on American soil in times of great civil unrest. So why are unelected military leaders undermining this president's authority to do the same? Regardless of Trump's manifest defects, said Damon Linker in TheWeek.com, there is something more than a little unnerving about military leaders publicly challenging an elected president. It raises the specter of a military coup. It's not a military coup that threatens our democracy, said Dexter Filkins in NewYorker.com. The much greater threat is that if Trump suffers a narrow defeat in November, he'll refuse to leave office and ask a friendly red state governor to deploy the National Guard to Washington, D.C., to surround the White House. Under Trump, nightmare scenarios are all too easy to imagine, said The Economist in an editorial. While it's reassuring that the generals for now are willing to stand up to him, the fact that it falls to them to do so is an indictment of the state of American politics and shows how close we truly are to the abyss. It was a good week for ups and downs after the first American woman to walk in space also became the first woman to visit the deepest part of the Pacific Ocean. A once-in-a-lifetime day, said astronaut Kathy Sullivan, 68, after completing a 35,810-foot dive in the Challenger Deep. It was a good week for drive-through Botox, offered by Florida plastic surgeon Michael Salhauer to residents still wary of the coronavirus. Botox injections of masked patients are really ideal, said Salhauer, because they combat wrinkles in the forehead and the corners of the eyes, exactly the parts of the face that aren't covered by the mask. And it was a good week for hope after Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, said the U.S. would fund Phase 3 human trials of three different coronavirus vaccines this summer. Fauci said he's optimistic a vaccine will be approved for use by early 2021. But it was a bad week for the lost cause after HBO temporarily removed Gone with the Wind from its streaming service, saying this was not a good time for a film romanticizing slavery and the antebellum South. It was a bad week for Cleveland, whose mayor, Frank Jackson, said in an interview that there is a public perception that his city is the butthole of the world. A spokesman later said it was unfortunate that angry Clevelanders were focusing on 7 seconds of a 50-minute interview. Finally, it was a bad week for idle hands after President Trump broke his personal record for tweets sent in a single day, with 200 tweets and retweets on June 5th including 74 tweets in 1 hour. He retweeted conservative activist Candace Owens' claim that George Floyd was not a good person and that it sickens her that he has been held up as a martyr. And before we move on, here's a short news piece. Trump uses pandemic to cancel regulations. President Trump signed an executive order last week instructing federal agencies to bypass environmental reviews of pipelines, highways, and other infrastructure projects because of the pandemic-induced economic emergency. The new order follows an earlier directive telling agencies to rescind or waive any regulations they legally could if they impeded growth. The changes have made it harder for Americans to challenge inaccuracies on credit reports and have eased rules requiring breaks for commercial truckers. Trump's orders also relaxed rules for how businesses report sick leave and how factories and power plants report emissions. The Washington Post reports the White House has taken roughly 600 deregulatory actions since the pandemic began and hopes to make many of them permanent. We're on the briefing page. Title of today's article is The Origins of Antifa. President Trump is blaming a radical leftist group for organizing violent protests and attacks on police. Is this true? What is Antifa? It's an umbrella movement of leftist and anti-racist rather than an actual group. Antifa, actually pronounced Antifa by some and Antifa by others, adherents see their mission as using direct action, up to and including violence, to fight fascism and the alt-right. They believe that law enforcement is complicit in white supremacy and that democracy is in danger. The term had its origins in the anti-fascist groups that sprang up in Germany and the UK in the 1930s, and members believe that the Nazis would not have been able to take power in Germany if anti-fascists had fought them aggressively. The first American group to use the term was the Rose City Antifa in Portland, Oregon in 2007. Because there is no leadership, hierarchy, or organized recruitment, anyone can call themselves Antifa. It's like calling Deadheads or Red Sox Nation an organization, said Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. It's unclear how many people identify as Antifa, but it's probably a few thousand at most. It is certain that they make up only a tiny fraction of the hundreds of thousands of Americans who have been demonstrating in more than 100 cities against the killing of George Floyd. Nonetheless, Attorney General William Barr has blamed Antifa and other similar extremist groups for hijacking the protests to instigate violence. Has Antifa been violent in the past? Yes, at times. Most Antifa activists, says Mark Bray, a history professor and author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, focus on trying to identify the names, addresses, and jobs of white supremacists who are active on the internet and outing them to their employers and the public. It's a lot of a kind of private investigator work that sometimes spills out into the streets with confrontations, Bray said. Still, there have been violent attacks. In 2012, militants from Anti-Racist Action, loosely associated with Antifa, stormed a Chicago-area restaurant where a white supremacist group was meeting, attacking with baseball bats and hammers and injuring several people. Five of them pleaded guilty to armed violence. After President Trump's inauguration in 2017, a masked activist punched neo-Nazi Richard Spencer in the face. The next month, a group of some 150 masked black-clad activists interrupted what had been a peaceful protest against an appearance by right-wing provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos in Berkeley, California, throwing fireworks, smashing windows, and hurling rocks. Later that year, Antifa activists battled white supremacists in Charlottesville, Virginia. What happened in Charlottesville? Hundreds of counter-protesters, including some who identify as Antifa, showed up at Unite the Right's white supremacist rally in August 2017. Witnesses there, including Jewish and Christian clergy, say that they were being physically threatened by neo-Nazis wielding semi-automatic rifles, clubs, and torches when Antifa members inserted their own bodies as shields. Fistfights and mace spraying broke out. One neo-Nazi was convicted of homicide when he rammed his car into a crowd, killing protester Heather Heyer, 32. "We would have been crushed like cockroaches if it were not for the anarchist and the anti-fascist," said activist and Harvard professor Cornel West. What about Barr's allegations? Internal FBI documents leaked to the Nation show that FBI's Washington field office has no intelligence indicating Antifa involvement / presence in the D.C. area protests. In other areas, experts say Antifa is simply too small a presence to be a driving force in protests. Witnesses have said they saw both black-clad militant activists who could be Antifa and white supremacist agitators breaking windows and starting fires. But records show that the vast majority of those arrested were from local communities. Many looters, police said, were professional criminals. What has President Trump said? He blamed Antifa-led anarchists for violent protests and has vowed to designate Antifa as a terrorist organization. Under U.S. law, however, only foreign actors such as Al-Qaeda or the Irish Republican Army can be so defined. Critics have accused Trump and Barr of focusing on Antifa as an excuse to invoke the Insurrection Act, call out the military, and put U.S. soldiers on the streets of American cities. Writing in the New York Times last week, Senator Tom Cotton, Republican from Arkansas, called for an overwhelming show of force against cadres of left-wing radicals like Antifa infiltrating protest marches. Is Antifa active on social media? Since Floyd's killing, Twitter and Facebook have taken down what Twitter called hundreds of spammy accounts, many purporting to be Antifa and calling for violence against police or white neighborhoods. Several of those have been traced to the white supremacist groups Identify, Europa, Proud Boys, and American Guard. On Facebook over the past week, rumors of imminent Antifa attacks and riots in small towns and suburbs have put local law enforcement on alert. The attacks never materialized. "I don't think there was any truth to it," said John Lane, chief of police in East Liverpool, Ohio, who put on extra patrols after a Facebook page attributed to Antifa threatened a suburban riot. "But I think this is going to go on until Election Day." The Boogaloo Movement. Boogaloo, which takes its name from the ridiculously titled 1984 movie sequel, Breakin' 2 Electric Boogaloo, is a loosely organized far-right movement that includes gun enthusiasts and white supremacists who say they want to trigger a race war that will bring down the U.S. government. Like Antifa, there are no formal leaders or organization, and most of the action seems to take place online. But many Boogaloo followers have appeared at COVID-19 lockdown protests, armed and wearing Hawaiian shirts, and some have now begun showing up at the ongoing protest against police brutality. In recent years, police say they have foiled several domestic terrorist plots by those claiming to follow the ideology. Last week, three ex-military men who police say self-identify as Boogaloo Boys were arrested on the way to a Las Vegas Black Lives Matter protest with full gas cans and Molotov cocktails in their car. And it's time to read a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with the NFL's phony reversal on kneeling. It was a stunning turnaround, said Joel Anderson, but a morally bankrupt one. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell announced last week that the league had been wrong to ban players kneeling during the national anthem as a peaceful protest against police mistreatment of African Americans. In 2018, the NFL caved into pressure from white fans and President Trump, who said owners should fire any, quote, son of a bitch who knelt during the anthem. Fearing a fan backlash, the league and its billionaire white owners told players that if they would not stand for the anthem, they should remain in the locker room. But peaceful protests against racism have become dramatically more acceptable since the nation saw a cop brutally kill George Floyd on a Minneapolis street, and the streets have filled with massive multiracial crowds demanding change. Even celebrities, corporations, and many other brands are now publicly supporting Black Lives Matter. The league knows it can no longer tell its African-American players to hide their anguish in the locker room, but let's not confuse this sudden change of course with a sincere change of heart. The NFL has simply made a new calculation about what its white fans find acceptable. If Hong Kong falls, Taiwan is next. The U.S. and the West have a moral obligation to stand up for Hong Kong, said Garry Kasparov. China's imposition of a new security law violates its commitment under an international treaty to give Hong Kong a high degree of autonomy and self-rule, and is a direct challenge to the values of free, democratic nations. Having gotten away with its brutal repression of the Uyghur Muslim minority in western China, Beijing doesn't believe the international community has the will or ability to deter it from this latest crackdown. Western nations have consistently been loath to risk the economic benefits of trading with China, even after Beijing helped cause the devastating coronavirus pandemic by suppressing information out of Wuhan. The time has come for the UK and the US to coordinate a global response to China's deception and vicious repression. Hong Kongers who want to flee should be welcomed in all Western nations, and sanctions should be slapped on Chinese officials complicit in violating human rights. Most importantly, the West must consider formally recognizing Taiwan as a separate, independent nation. That would infuriate China, but anything less will be shrugged off by Beijing as a price they are willing to pay. This is from Europe. Reckoning with racism, past and present. Inspired by anti-police brutality protests in the U.S., hundreds of thousands of Europeans are rallying in the streets under the banner of Black Lives Matter, said Afua Hirsch in The Guardian. As well they should. What black people are experiencing the world over is a system that finds their bodies expendable, by design, a template that was forged by European colonial powers. It was Britain that industrialized black enslavement in the Caribbean and exported that system to America. The racism that killed George Floyd, the African-American suffocated by a white police officer in Minneapolis, was built in Britain. and this country still treats black Britons as second-class citizens. We are more likely to die in police custody than whites, and now we are dying disproportionately of COVID-19. Floyd's death was horrific, said Melanie Phillips in the Times, but cowed British authorities are letting the protesters riot. Demonstrators have hurled bottles at police, defaced a statue of Winston Churchill, and burned a Union Jack at a war memorial. When protesters in Bristol toppled a statue of 17th century slave trader Edward Colston and rolled it into the River Avon, the city's police chief sympathized with rioters, saying, "I do understand why it's happened. It's very symbolic." What an abdication of duty. Vandalism and thuggery should be punished, not justified. The rally in Brussels was dedicated to Floyd, said Ludovine Ponchot in La Soie from Belgium, but also to people of color who have died in Belgium at the hands of police in recent years. Many of the 7,000 demonstrators carried placards bearing the names of the dead. Mehdi, a 17-year-old run over by a police cruiser as he tried to evade a checkpoint. Mada, a 2-year-old Kurdish-Iraqi girl killed when police fired on a van smuggling migrants. Lamine, 27, who died in unknown circumstances while officers were evicting him from an apartment. Belgians are also looking more deeply at their history, said Colette Breckman. Statues of King Leopold II, whose genocidal colonial regime brutalized the Congo in the late 1800s, killing some 10 million people, are being vandalized all over the country, and a civic movement to take them down is amassing followers. Leopold's troops were able to conquer the Congo only because the slave trade had depopulated villages there and weakened African resistance. Floyd's own ancestors have been captured in the forests of Central Africa to be taken away, chained, in the hold of a slave ship. Some of these demonstrations, though, are simply inappropriate performance art, said Emma Jensen in Uppsala Nya Tidning from Sweden. Police had to break up a Stockholm protest because it breached the 50-person limit on public gatherings. The officers were right to do so. We're in the middle of a pandemic. How obnoxious of the Swedish demonstrators to carry signs reading, "I can't breathe," when their very presence risks spreading a disease that threatens the breath of vulnerable people such as the elderly and the ill. Stand up for African Americans, sure. Just don't risk Swedish lives to do so. It's time for The Last Word, our in-depth article, titled this week, "A Reckoning for Texas Liberal Bastion." Austin has long imagined itself as a progressive oasis, said Peter Holly in the Washington Post, but the police's violent response to protest has shown white residents a different view of the city. Steve Aron remembers the moment he no longer recognized Austin, the city he has called home for nearly two decades. The 43-year-old volunteer medic was on a grassy embankment rushing to the aid of an injured protester in downtown Austin. Perched atop an elevated highway to his left, police officers were unleashing a volley of beanbag rounds into a crowd of demonstrators surrounding him. Despite wearing a brightly colored vest adorned with red medical crosses, Aron was shot in the wrist and thigh, making him one of hundreds of people injured by police weaponry during 2 days of protest across downtown Austin last weekend. The level of brutality was shocking, an astonished Aron said a day later, his wrist bandaged and his leg marked by a dark red and purple bruise. "I just couldn't believe something like this was happening in Austin." The People's Republic of Austin is reeling as protests against police brutality have swept the nation in the wake of George Floyd's killing in Minneapolis, the laid-back liberal oasis in Central Texas has witnessed some of the most acute violence in the country, a development that shocked many residents as well as the city's liberal leadership. At a six-hour-long emergency city council meeting to review police protocols, hundreds of Austinites berated city leaders and called for the police chief's ouster. An editorial in the Austin American Statesman said the police response compounded the outrage and pain that brought protesters to the streets to begin with. Reached by phone, Austin Mayor Steve Adler, a Democrat, said videos of the violence made him incredibly uncomfortable. "It didn't seem right," he added. But the shock did not extend to the east side of Interstate 35, a concrete rampart that has for decades sliced this community in half, both physically and culturally. In traditionally black and Hispanic neighborhoods on the city's east side, residents said the only thing surprising about police turning their weapons on the public is that anyone is still surprised when it occurs. "The idea that this is a progressive city is just a liberal fantasy," said Nelson Linder, president of the Austin NAACP. Like the pandemic that has spread unevenly across the U.S., protests over Floyd's death have exposed fault lines and frailties that have festered beneath the surface of cities nationwide. Austin police pledged this week to stop firing beanbag projectiles into large crowds after several black and Hispanic protesters were badly injured. A 16-year-old Hispanic teenager was struck in the head, and a 20-year-old black man, Justin Howell, was nearly killed by less lethal ammunition. Relatives of Howell, a Texas State University student, say doctors have told them he has a fractured skull and brain damage. In another instance, police shot a pregnant black woman with an impact munition that left her screaming for her baby, a harrowing scene that circulated widely on social media, unleashing fury across town. At nightly protests outside police headquarters, demonstrators have begun holding signs calling for city leaders to defund the police. During a public address last week, Austin Police Chief Brian Manley looked pained and held back tears as he said the incidents had left him crushed. But for many Austinites, the chief's comments were little more than performative penance, a disingenuous exercise in deflecting blame. "I'm sad and heartbroken," said Eugene Sepulveda, a prominent Austin philanthropist and entrepreneur and a senior advisor to Adler, the mayor. "I have been in touch with our hired officials and elected officials, expressing very loudly that this is not the Austin we know and love." The alarm reflects the sense of exceptionalism built into the fabric of Austin's psyche. Like a blue life raft in a sea of Texas red, the taco-obsessed, music festival-embracing city long ago fashioned itself as a bohemian refuge for musicians, poets, intellectuals, and slackers. Even now, nearly half a century past its hippie heyday, many Austinites consider their city more livable, beautiful, and liberal than most places in America. Each afternoon, the city's blue-green waterways and parks fill with carefree crowds of young white people basking in the sun, throwing flying discs, and floating on paddleboards. "Austin is a really cool place for people that are not aware of the injustice occurring in the world," said Chas Moore, founder of the Austin Justice Coalition. "I tell people all the time, Austin is white people's Atlanta. It's where a white person can come and fit right in and go anywhere and see themselves." In the traditionally black and Hispanic neighborhoods on the city's east side, residents describe a different reality. Only a month ago, local activists noted, Austin police shot and killed unarmed 42-year-old Mike Ramos. At protests across the city, some black Austinites say they're regularly the victims of police brutality. "I've lived here my whole life, and the first time I saw a cop kill someone innocent, I was in elementary school," said Anthony Evans, 25, referring to the death of 18-year-old Daniel Rocha in 2005. "It was traumatizing, and we can't take these things anymore." Rocha's death resulted in a $1 million settlement, among more than $8 million in settlements the city doled out for wrongful shooting deaths involving Austin police between 2005 and 2017, according to CBS Austin. Even Austin protesters have been accused of racial ignorance in recent days after the only black-owned business on East 6th Street, the heart of the city's downtown entertainment district, was looted. People talk about Black Lives Matter and investing in the black community, and then go out and harm the only black business owner in the area, Moore said. How does that make any sense? Adler, the mayor, maintains that the city has made significant strides in recent years, among them raising the minimum wage for city employees to $15 an hour and embracing the Green New Deal espoused by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. The city created an equity office to evaluate the impact city policies have on vulnerable populations. In 2018, the city council voted to make Austin the state's first Freedom City, a designation tied to a set of policies that keep police from inquiring about someone's immigration status and decriminalize petty offenses that ensnare disproportionate numbers of minorities in the criminal justice pipeline. "We've been having a consistent conversation for years about the things that are not working well, and we've been able to get a lot of things done," Adler said. But Linder, the NAACP president, who moved to the state capital from southern Georgia in 1980, said Austin has long suffered from the same racist attitudes that defined life in the Deep South, though less overt ones. "The dissonance between perception and reality," he said, "helps to explain the bewilderment white Austinites feel when they're forced to confront police violence. In Austin, folks pretend they're liberal, but they've never dealt with these racial issues before. This city is very inexperienced in dealing with conflicts between black people and white people, police and minorities, and if there's any confrontation, they're not prepared for it." Linder's office is located in a traditionally black neighborhood that has been losing residents for decades, most of them forced out by skyrocketing housing prices that have accompanied the city's transformation from a lazy college town and live music mecca to an overpriced, traffic-clogged technopolis known as Silicon Hills. Though they are separated by only a few miles, there is a 10-year difference in life expectancy between the city's wealthy west side and the poorer east side. In 2015, the Martin Prosperity Institute revealed that Austin has the highest level of economic segregation of any large metro area in the nation. In downtown Austin, Russell Banger, a 36-year-old white protester, said he felt that the city's economic disparities influenced whether police targeted demonstrators with high-velocity weapons during recent protests. "I think a lot of police will automatically assume when they aim at a black person that they fall within a lower economic class and don't have resources," Banger said. "A white person, we get the benefit of the doubt. They think we might be property owners or someone worth caring about." In response, some white demonstrators began silently standing in front of black and Hispanic protesters when they were engaging with police, turning their bodies into shields. "As a white person, we are here to listen and use our bodies to protect and shield black and Hispanic people," said Danielle Reichman, 33. "I've seen more white people deciding to use their privilege like that." Despite initiatives such as decriminalizing minor offenses, Adler said he was under no illusions about the festering racial issues inside the Austin Police Department. Last year, City Manager Spencer Kronk launched an investigation into the department after allegations surfaced that an assistant chief had repeatedly referred to President Barack Obama and a longtime black city councilwoman by using the N-word. Though a final report found no evidence of the alleged offenses in text messages, The findings led some city council members to call for a radical shift in the department's culture. City leaders decided to delay the start of the department's newest cadet class to make changes to curriculum related to race, mental health, and de-escalation tactics. The idea, Adler said, was to create a curriculum that ensured officers would behave more like community protectors than warriors. That conversation was ongoing. Adler said when Floyd was killed and Austin police, like departments all across the country, found themselves in riot gear facing off with thousands of angry protesters. "I think this is still a pretty magical place, a city of innovators and early adopters that on so many levels each day is doing things right," Adler said. "I look at our city and think we are a progressive place, but like the other cities around the country, this moment has revealed we have a long way to go." This article originally appeared in the Washington Post. We're on the Health and Science page, where the lead article is "Herd Immunity Not on the Horizon." The world is still a long way from achieving herd immunity to COVID-19. That's the troubling takeaway from a crop of new serology studies into how many people have contracted the disease, reports the New York Times. The researchers examined blood samples for antibodies, proteins generated by the immune system that indicate a past infection and that usually provide protection against catching the same virus again. The threshold for COVID-19 herd immunity is unknown, but most epidemiologists think 60% to 80% of the population will have to have been infected. In hard-hit cities around the world where serology surveys have been conducted, none comes close to that level. In New York, an estimated 19.9% of residents have antibodies. In London, 17.5%. In Boston, Stockholm, and Barcelona, the rate is still in single digits. That suggests herd immunity may be a pipe dream until a vaccine is developed. Michael Meany, an epidemiologist at Harvard University, said there's currently no safe way to build up herd immunity unless we're going to let the virus run rampant again, but I think society has decided that is not an approach available to us. Serology tests also provide scientists with a more accurate picture of how deadly the coronavirus is. Figures from New York City suggest that about 1% of those who contract the disease will die from it. And we'll turn on over to the Talking Points page. Rebellion at the Times: What's Fit to Print? An unprecedented staff rebellion at the New York Times last week forced journalists to reconsider deep questions about what can count as permissible opinion, said Joe Pompeo in VanityFair.com. The outcry came in response to an op-ed by Senator Tom Cotton, the Republican from Arkansas, headlined, "Send in the Troops." Cotton called for an overwhelming show of force from military forces to crush nihilist protesters who, he said, are simply out for loot and the thrill of destruction. Dozens of Times journalists, mostly young reporters, expressed outrage, saying the op-ed put black staffers in danger. Editorial page editor James Bennett came under such withering internal criticism, he resigned. With the country on edge, the Times decided Cotton's inflammatory demand for troops on the streets was the equivalent of shouting fire in a crowded theater. "The role of an opinion section is to foster debate," said Kevin Williamson in NationalReview.com. By that standard, an op-ed by a prominent U.S. senator about invoking the Insurrection Act was eminently worth publishing. Liberals should have the courage to win these debates on the merits, not by silencing the enemy, which is how they see every Republican. To justify censoring Cotton, the Times staffers claimed the op-ed threatened their workplace safety. And Robbie Sove in The Reason, woke young people have learned to weaponize safetyism against anyone who disagrees with them, and this trend should concern everyone. Newsrooms, college campuses, and the society at large shouldn't live in fear of difficult conversations. In this case, the threat to safety is not imaginary, said Margaret Sullivan in WashingtonPost.com. During the protests, hundreds of journalists and thousands of protesters have been clubbed, beaten, and pepper sprayed by militarized cops. In this polarized, dangerous moment, journalists are facing difficult questions about their role in society. Many news consumers say, "Just tell me the bare facts." That sounds appealing, but in reality, all journalism is the product of choices. Every day, we decide what to amplify, what to investigate, and what not to publish. Should deniers of the Sandy Hook massacre be featured on newspaper op-ed pages? Of course not. Cotton's views were worth including in a balanced news story, but his evidence-free claim that only a military crackdown could stop cadres of left-wing radicals like Antifa did not deserve the Times' imprimatur. Systemic racism, is it real? A horrifying video of George Floyd's death has proven to most Americans that police racism is real, said Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times. But we have no video showing us the structural racism that has left African Americans still living in a separate country from whites. Generations of systemic discrimination and oppression have left an enduring mark. The net worth of the average black household is just 10% of that of whites, an even greater gulf than in 1968. Today, a black newborn is twice as likely to die in infancy, and those born in poor southern states have a shorter life expectancy than children born in Bangladesh. Though the Jim Crow era is supposedly over, black children are systematically shunted to largely segregated schools that receive a fraction of the funding enjoyed by schools in wealthy white suburbs. The problem isn't the character flaws of a few bad apples, but the racism that infects every major institution in this country, said Leonard Pitts Jr. in the Miami Herald. We have a rotten tree. Systemic racism is a canard, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. Liberals love to cherry-pick statistics to support their tunnel vision about race, but many of the institutions deemed irredeemably racist, such as academia and journalism, overflow with political progressives. Many African Americans do succeed in our supposedly racist society. For those who will still struggle, it's the paternalistic progressive agenda, not racism, that keeps them trapped in victimhood and dependency. Leftist radicals use the term systemic racism to justify overthrowing our institutions and remaking society, said John Hershauer, also in NationalReview.com. Capitalism is white supremacy, they insist. Immigration enforcement is racist, and so is patriotism. In short, the entire Republican agenda is a species of racism. Republicans, meanwhile, barely concede that racism exists, said Bronald Brownstein in CNN.com. One of the modern GOP's core convictions is that widespread racism is no longer a problem. Indeed, support for Donald Trump is highly correlated with the belief that it's whites who suffer from racial prejudice. But Floyd's death has triggered a sea change in public attitudes. The coalition of people who see racism as real and requiring major structural change is strikingly broad and diverse. As Trump attacks protesters as radicals and thugs, he is betting his presidency that most Americans agree that systemic racism is a myth. And we have time for a few of the short notes. the last American receiving a Civil War pension has died at the age of 90. Irene Triplett received $73.13 a month for her father, Mose Triplett's service in the 3rd North Carolina Mounted Infantry, a Union regiment known as Kirk's Raiders, which carried out a campaign of sabotage. Mose, who fathered Irene at the age of 83, died in 1938 at the age of 92. Las Vegas casinos were allowed to reopen last week, 78 days after they were shut down. Employees are required to wear masks, but patrons are not, though they do undergo temperature checks. On the poll watch, 80% of Americans say that the country is spiraling out of control. 59% are more concerned about police actions in the death of George Floyd than by the violence at some protest, while 27% are more concerned about the violent protests. 63% remain concerned they or a member of their family will get the coronavirus. And we'll finish with a quote from George Eliot. What do we live for if it is not to make life less difficult for each other? And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. The number is 919-832-5138.